It is good to be back together on this gathering Sunday. For those of you who were here this summer, you will know that we have been considering some spiritual practices informed by the book of Luke. And Jason and I, and with the help of Charlie, have provided podcasts of our sermons together with a practice we can try in the coming week. Jason and I will be continuing this practice this fall, beginning with the season of creation. In this next month, we will be moving off the regular lectionary. We will be considering some passages in this good book that we do not often read, and we will celebrate the season of creation. This season is now marked in many Christian denominations in all parts of the world. It began with a day in September marked by the Eastern Orthodox Church and has grown to be a season that covers a month and ends in the Roman Catholic tradition with the feast of St. Francis of Assisi. Now, St. Francis was a monk who lived in Italy in the 1200s. He established the Order of the Franciscans. Some of you know that, and it's an order of monks that still exists today. He was a man who drew his faith mostly from nature. He tended to look down at the earth and not up at the heavens for the presence of God, for the informing of his faith. In our time, his most famous follower right now seems to be Richard Rohr. Some of you know, I know, receive his daily reflections. They are well worth reading. In the creed we share together in word each week, we speak of a God who has created and is creating. I think this is true, and we will explore this further in the season of creation over the next month. Now, this creation time, we didn't pull it out of the blue. It has its roots in the early church calendar. These were called ember days, quarterly periods during the early church that marked the changing of the seasons. These festivals long predated Christianity, and indeed long predated pagan times. The changing of the seasons has always been with us. And now in its drive to be accepted by local populations, the church kind of took over these days and others like it, and then gradually moved away from most connections to the created world. And we celebrated the life, death, and resurrection of our Jesus. In a bit simplistic terms, the world around us, on which we depend for life, could not be tamed, could not be understood, and our eyes moved heavenward, looking beyond this unpredictable, dangerous thing called nature. The there and then of heaven or hell-bound humans became the lifelong goal, governing all action and inaction, and the here and now became a temporary state to be endured until we shuffled off this mortal coil. We were given dominion by God, and by God we exercise it. With the incomplete understanding, we who were made in the image of God, we were given free rein to dominate. The natural world was seen in terms of retribution or reward for the breaking or keeping of moral codes or laws laid down by countless iterations of human-led governing structures, of religions and cultures and governments down the ages. It is a human-centric view of the world. We are the center, and all revolved around us. We see this still today in the blaming of floods and famine and disease on those who are suffering as being brought on by themselves, by their actions or their way of loving. And today also, as humans on this blue planet revolving through space, we have grasped, and this is good news, we have grasped the ability for deeper, wider thought, where we are not the center, but stewards, where the bubonic plague is understood as the result of the transmission of bacteria to humans through the bite of a flea, and not the punishment of an angry God visited on individuals. Where an earthquake is the result of shifting tectonic plates and not the punishment of an angry God visited on countries. It was Blaise Pascal who said, "Man is only a reed, the weakest in nature, but he is a thinking reed." And this Job read so powerfully and beautifully today, this Job we read is one of those thinking reads. Job is one of the earliest books of the Hebrew Testament. Its proper place in the canon in terms of dates would be that it was written around the time of Genesis, written in the 6th century BCE, in what Coleridge called poetry of the highest caste. It is the story of a man, quite simply, wrestling with the very question of why bad things happen. Why disaster or flood or famine? The cry of "why me" rings out from this passage today. And God answers with evidence all around Job. He answers with creation. He answers with all the questions about the created world that Job could not know. "Where were you," God asks, "when I laid the foundation of the earth? Where were you when I shut in the sea with doors when it burst from the womb? Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Who are you," God asks Job, "who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" And the passage continues, the poem continues, and we will hear more of it over the next few weeks. And finally, Job responds to God out of his misery and his sorry state, out of his understanding and the limits of his understanding. And he says, "I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you." Out of the limited understanding of a writer some 2,600 years ago, written down long before we landed on the moon or understood the tides, long before the identification of genes or viruses or neutrons or electrons, long before we studied the water cycle or untangled the web of life, we hear of this Job recognizing the presence of God in all he sees. The evidence of his eyes, as overwhelming as it is to him, must be sufficient, as it still is today. And as it is Ocean Sunday, a Sunday to celebrate the oceans, let's canvas a bit of what that means. What we have uncovered so far, we actually don't discover anything. We uncover. What we have uncovered so far, facts about our oceans, what do we see today? 70% of the earth is ocean. 94% of all life forms on earth live in those oceans. Over half of the oxygen we breathe, and that is a conservative estimate, over half of the oxygen we breathe is produced by seaweed and phytoplankton that live in the ocean. Ocean life forms began 3 billion years ago. In comparison, land-based creatures appeared only 400 million years ago. There are some 33,000 species of fish. Antarctica contains as much ice as the Atlantic Ocean does water. The longest mountain range in the world, and I found this fascinating, is under the oceans, and it's 40,000 miles long. The Great Barrier Reef, measuring some 1,200 miles, is the largest living structure on Earth and can be seen from the moon. A new form of life was discovered recently based on chemical energy rather than light. And it resides in deep sea hydrothermal vents along the ocean floor. A swallow of ocean may contain millions of bacterial cells, hundreds and thousands of phytoplankton, and tens of thousands zooplankton. Fish supply the greatest percentage of the world's protein consumed by humans. And lastly, oceans absorb between 30 and 50% of the carbon dioxide produced by burning fossil fuels. That we are here is a miracle in the true definition of the word. From the Big Bang to bacteria to biological cell division to the march of evolution to oceans pulled by tides and all kept here by gravity, to eyes that see and ears that hear, air to breathe, water to drink, to intelligence and to reasoning, to you and to me. Heck, even with our present knowledge, and I would argue because of our present knowledge, we can see evidence of God even more clearly than Job. And then there are also the facts about the present state of our oceans that hurt. 60% of our reefs are in danger. Carbon dioxide is hurting the plankton. The water is warming. In 1 year, 3 times as much rubbish is dumped into the world's oceans as the weight of fish caught. A single quart of motor oil can contaminate up to 2 million gallons of drinking water. And we could also speak of plastic floating islands and ice caps melting. We are said to be in the image of God. We are said to have been made in the image of God. Well, consider this. All is made in the image of God. And we, out of all that lives on God's holy mountain, to quote scripture, we are given the power to destroy and to build up, the power to love and to hate, the power to choose, to take all manner of actions and inactions. All of this is given to us. Awesome responsibility and an equally awesome opportunity. A boy asked a man, "How or what do you worship?" And the man replied, "How would courage and truth and mercy and right actions strike you?" Astonished, the boy said, "But those are not God." And the man, equally astonished, replied, "For heaven's sake, what do you think God looks like when God works in humankind?" Now, I was speaking with Reverend Jason Myers this week about the sentence that I was pondering to inform this sermon. And the sentence is, humankind has the right not to be miserable. And he responded to me with the First Nations teaching that says, humankind has the responsibility not to be miserable. And consider that perhaps the evidence for that teaching, both the right and the responsibility, is as plain as the oceans of our world. So for today, what the writer of Job is, I think, saying, and it's always a matter of interpretation, but what I think the writer of Job is saying, see what is displayed around you. See with eyes widened by knowledge to date. Today, see the remarkable power and beauty of the oceans. And let what you see inform your actions. Meister Eckhart, who was an early Christian mystic, had this to say: if the only prayer you ever say in your life is thank you, it will be enough. Jesus said, truly I tell you, unless you become as a little child, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And how do children react to creation, to the world around them, with trust, with openness, with wonder, with unconditional acceptance, with unreserved gratitude, at least until they are taught otherwise, by lack of water, or clean air, or shelter? Humankind has the responsibility not to be miserable. On an individual level, on the level of you and me, that means honest looks at ourselves, our motivations, our assumptions, and seeking to carve out the time and the opportunities for personal growth and for honest reflection. It means operating out of an attitude of gratitude that we have been given by abundance. I wrote this thinking of a time spent with some 20 others looking out in meditation over the confluence of two great bodies of water, Lake Ontario and the St. Lawrence River, witness to and experiencing the opposite of misery, the joy of being in the presence of God. And as a collective, humankind has the right not to be miserable. Through our honest reflection and examination of lifestyle and sense of entitlement as to our place on this planet, we can realize and act on the responsibility to lessen the misery of others who are no less than ourselves, made in the image of God. So I have this to suggest this morning. The opposite of evil is perhaps not good. Perhaps the opposite of evil is sacred. The opposite of evil is sacred. Changing our heartfelt conviction about what is sacred will give us the courage and indeed the conviction, moral and social and political and religious, will give us the conviction to change our ways in the world. We will act out of gratitude for this incredible gift to protect and foster that which is sacred, that which is holy. We were not there when God laid the foundation of the earth. We were not there when God shut in the sea with doors, when it burst from the womb. Yet wondrously and insanely amazing, we now have some more words of knowledge about how those things came to happen. And we have entered the springs of the seas and have traveled in a tiny bit of the recesses of the deep. And the more we uncover about the oceans, about how they support all life, the more grateful and faithful we become. So first, we may be reeds, fragile reeds, and we may have made wrong-headed decisions, done, as one of my sons would say, boneheaded things. We may have walked a road that's littered with evidence of our own fragility. You may see yourself as a reed so badly bent you cannot imagine straightening out again. You may be so wrapped up in doing things that you do not see any other way. You may have tried fleeing or bluffing or denying. You may have built a wall so high around your sense of religion and your sense of God that you cannot imagine even how to take part of it down. You may be in a place of sadness, of why me, or a place of nihilism, why anything. You may have looked for solace in accumulation, in the bottle, in busyness, in any number of things that distract. You may be so wrapped up in the fear of death, your death, or the death of a loved one, that life holds so much meaning you can't face it. So that's the first thing. Open yourself up to your fragility. Second, you are a thinking reed. And not only thinking, but capable of passion and compassion, capable of seeing possibilities and recognizing the sacred in this creation. You are capable of opening yourself up to understanding faith in ways always available, but perhaps not recognized. All that lives was meant to be in relationship with God, is in relationship with God. What a relief. And what a right. And what a responsibility. The heavens and earth tell the glory of God. Our Charter of Rights and Freedoms in our Constitution of this country says, everyone has the following fundamental freedoms: freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of thought, belief, opinion, and expression, freedom of peaceful assembly, and freedom of association. And I would add another this morning: freedom from misery. The right and the responsibility to joy. Amen.